This is the Biblical Mind Podcast, produced by the Center for Hebraic Thought. Honest five-star reviews help others find this podcast. Visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org for articles and videos that explore the deep structures of Scripture.
You know, it's been said that a text taken out of context is a pretext for a proof text. And you can do a little proof at that point. And I think that is also the case with the Bible. The Bible didn't just form in a vacuum. It didn't just fall from heaven to us. But instead, it was written in a context, in a world where Hebraic thought and Greco-Roman thought was... I talk about intersection, where there's the intersection of Christian writings, Judaism, writings of Judaism, writings of Greco-Roman philosophy, but probably even more than an intersection that is just static. It's probably more of a roundabout. You and I both lived in Scotland where roundabouts were all around. And there's this constant influence between these. It's funny, when I was raised in a missionary Baptist church right on the Arkansas-Louisiana line, at the church that pretty much was anti-intellectual. All we needed was a Bible. All we needed was the gospel. And that dissuaded me from going to seminary, because seminary was cemetery. But I had this one Sunday school teacher that she didn't fall into that category. And when I graduated from high school, she gave me two volumes, Josephus and Philo. You know, exactly right. And it was really prophetic. And she didn't even have a college education. She had dropped out of college because her husband got called to go to war in World War II. But she gave me these two. And she made this comment that if I really want to understand the Bible, I need to understand the writings that were surrounding the Bible. And I'd never heard of Josephus or Philo. And the book, the titles didn't really grab me. I was reading Left Behind series, I think, instead. But constantly it was interesting that that became really this voice of God through Miss Nancy Hall, that if I really want to understand the Bible, then I need to understand those works surrounding the Bible. And for me, my first cut my teeth in Josephus and Philo.
Well, that exact instance really hits different with me, because I have been telling people kind of nonstop, anybody who will listen, you know, I became a Christian in the early 90s when I was around 20 years old in a charismatic non-denominational church with a lot of older Christian. I mean, it was just a lot of people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. It wasn't a young hip church at all, as you can talk about now. But I remember... all these people, I would go to their house for dinner. And these are, you know, maybe people who became Christians in the Jesus movement, or, you know, they were like ecstatic Christians. You know, they're really excited about their Christianity. And a lot of them had conversion, they would say, from Catholicism or from Lutheranism, but they just meant they were raised Christian, but took it seriously when they had this conversion. And I can't tell you how many of them had Josephus and Eusebius on their shelves.
Wow.
And they were reading, and these, and again, they weren't anti-intellectual, but they weren't like super supportive of intellectualism, but there are just people, and I don't know, I haven't heard the story of who is selling these books to these people and convincing them, like, hey, you should probably read this stuff. There was always a cadre of people that had these books and were saying, oh yeah, I was reading Josephus the other, in Sunday school, you know, I was reading Josephus, and like, now who is he again? So that's fascinating that Miss Nancy Hall, Mrs. Nancy Hall, shout out to Mrs. Nancy Hall for doing that for you. Now, you use the roundabout analogy. That's fantastic. I love that. I'm going to steal that from you, and I will give you credit. Because there's people there's ideas getting on and off, and people coming through and getting little bits from here and there. You work specifically, or you've written a lot on the issue of Stoicism in the New Testament text and how those two things interact. Quickly, can you explain to us, what is Stoicism? And maybe, are there any modern versions of Stoicism? And then... and then maybe we can talk about how it's reflected in the New Testament text.
Sure. You know, back in the 90s, LL Cool J had a song that said, don't call it a comeback. I've been here for years. And Stoicism, one might say it's making a comeback, but it has been here for years. And it was the predominant philosophy in the first century, the time when the New Testament is being written, and it had greatly influenced the Hebraic thought that led up to the New Testament. It works like four Maccabees that would appear in our Apocrypha, Wisdom of Solomon. And so even the Middle Platonism, kind of the eclectic philosophy of the day, had a huge dose of Stoicism. And for the Stoics, we talk about them as philosophers, but their main gist was to overcome passions, to know the secret of contentment. And the way that one learned the secret of contentment, the way that one thought on whatever was good, whatever was right, whatever was pleasing, was focused on the mind, reason. You would have a guy like Epictetus, who wrote in Greek during the first century, and he would talk about how God had given us this spiritual act of worship, and that we weren't being conformed to the pattern of the world, but being transformed by the renewing of the mind, to borrow from Paul in Romans. And so a lot of overlap between Stoics and Christian thought. And we see this in Acts 17, even when Luke is presenting Paul before Mars Hill, the Areopagus. Paul quotes a Stoic there, right. A Stoic actually from Tarsus, where he was from. And we see that there were some Stoics that were in the audience. And of course, Paul convinces some of them, including some of their main women, to become believers. And so from the very beginning, the taproot of early Christianity, there was an inroad to the Stoics. And we see this in early Christian writings as well, them borrowing heavily on Stoics, Stoic thought. And so there's some good things about Stoicism. There may also be some pushbacks where Stoicism had overlapped had taken over some of the Jewish Christian thought, maybe like what we see in 1 Corinthians 15. For many of the Stoics, they did believe that there was an afterlife, the incorporeal body, having been influenced by Socrates and Plato. And so when you died, your spirit went and dwelt in the stars, where you shined light bright like a diamond. And so it may be that when Paul's giving this great argument in 1 Corinthians 15 about the bodily resurrection, the bodily resurrection, the bodily resurrection, it may be that there were some educated elite there in Corinth that was leaning more towards a Stoic conception of the afterlife more so than the bodily resurrection.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because it goes back to that question again of why study these texts outside of the biblical text? Well, all the apostles certainly, it's fair to say that Jesus was familiar with many of these texts, and the apostles, maybe even the unlearned Peter would have been as well. And certainly Paul is and is able to engage on those grounds and quote their own philosophers and poets back to them to make his point. And then I love that you pointed out, because even in Athens, he makes this grand point, and then he just twists the knife with something that nobody would believe in a historical event that they've never heard of and some guy they've never heard of. It's just, it's like the rhetoric there is confounding. So maybe for our audience, you and I, when we say Hellenistic worldview, Middle Platonism, we kind of have an idea. We have a couple hooks that we can hang those ideas on. So what are the big conceptions? You gave one that, you know, there's this incorporeal body, right? This incorporeal soul that when we die, it goes somewhere to the heavens or to the stars. I was just wondering if that's where Pink Floyd's Crazy Shine on You Diamond song is from. But can you give us just a generic overview of like, how do they conceive of the world? And then we can maybe think about how the Hebrews would accept some of that and push back on some of that.
Yeah, sure. You know, just like we would talk about, you and I, Drew, that there wasn't Second Temple Judaism. There were Second Temple Judaisms. Right. We would also say that there weren't Greco-Roman philosophy, but Greco-Roman philosophies. There were pre-Socratics, but really, if we're going to talk about Greco-Roman philosophy and Hellenism, we need to go back to Socrates. Socrates would be Mutatis Mutandis, with some obvious differences, but he would have been the Jesus to the Greeks. You know, also grew up in a meager background, was betrayed by his own people for challenging the tradition, introducing these new gods, corrupting young minds. In a kangaroo court, he was tried and convicted and was executed. But Socrates was known as the one who brought down heavenly wisdom, not to the ivory tower, but to the every person. And again, one of the lines that is often attributed to Socrates is that the unexamined life is not worth living. And so we need to question everything. And that included our conception of God, included who we are, the epistemology, which I think you know a little bit about, really comes kind of goes back. And then from Socrates, we have Plato. If Socrates was the Jesus of the Greco-Roman world, then Plato would kind of be like his beloved disciple, John, if you will, where he's going, Socrates himself never wrote anything. And so Plato is going to be the one who's going, the main one who's going to give us the life and the teaching of Socrates. And with Plato, if Plato is kind of the John, the fourth gospel, then the Romans, let me mix it up a little bit, but the Romans of Plato would be the Republic.
I love this analogy, by the way. This is great.
I'm sure it breaks down. If we have some professional philosophers, they're probably browbeating me. But in the Republic, again, the theme of Republic is how does one achieve the kaiosune? What is the righteous person? What is a righteous person? Who are the righteous people that rule? And what does that lead to the utopia where you have this this right world where everything is connected? And it's interesting where he's giving kind of political science. He's giving how we overcome our passions. He even talks about parenting in it. But it ends with this idea of this dude named Air, who had died. And he went to heaven after as was, if you will, to the afterlife. And there at the afterlife, he sees these guardians that are separating the righteous from the unrighteous, kind of like goats and sheep. And the wicked, they go down to Hades for 1,000 years, for a millennial, where they are punished to different degrees. Whereas the righteous, the sheep, they're the ones who go to heaven and they have a party on the rooftop, top of the world for 1,000 years.
What you're suggesting is that any person raised in the Greco-Roman environment, you know, whether you're in the diaspora or not, they might have picked up on these threads when John is writing his apocalyptic text, that he might be leaning both into the Hebrew Bible and into teaching, thinking, ideas, narratives, mythology of the day, even something like the sorting out after the judgment.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, I was using Matthew with the separating of the sheep from the goats. The 1,000-year reign is there. And it's interesting because John is the one who actually begins with this idea of the Logos. You know, he's going to be the most philosophical. Right. And even John's depiction of Jesus is very stoic. Whereas in, you know, the synoptics, Jesus is like, God, please don't let this cup, if there's any way, let this cup pass. And he's crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? But in John's gospel, Jesus is a lot like Socrates. He's like, hey, give me the cup. I'll drink it down to the dregs. And even while he's on the cross, you know, he's just cool and calm. So John would be probably the most philosophical of those. And again, going back to that first discussion that we have, there are some that think, well, the New Testament's just Jewish, or there those who may emphasize the Greco-Roman background of it. But really, the New Testament was a tertium quid. It was kind of this third thing that was undefined, that was drawing from those. And so, you know, with Paul, for example, the guy that I spend most of my time studying, he wasn't a rabbi and he wasn't a philosopher. He was both a rabbi and a philosopher, but even more than all of that. And so, the Plato's Republic would be, you know, N.T. Wright, professor at Oxford, he made a comment that Plato would be kind of like the New Testament for the Greeks. And so the myth of Air was really popular. They would have known this. Connected to Plato's allegory of the cave is also in the Republic. You also have in the Republic, and I may be getting off topic here. You got me excited. So feel free to push back. But in Plato's Republic, which is, you know, written centuries before the New Testament, the question is, who would be the righteous person? Who is a righteous one? And it would be one who'd be betrayed by his friends, who would be unjustly tried and put to death, a shameful death. And while he is being in his shameful death, he would forgive those who had betrayed him. And so, yeah, beautiful stuff there that you have. But anyway, so Plato would be kind of the one who really amplifies Socrates' voice and again, influencing, bringing his own thought into that. And then Aristotle would be the one after that. So these are the big three. And if we're going to, again, the comparison may break down, but if Plato is kind of like the John, Paul is going to kind of be like the Aristotle, where he is taking it and making it, going beyond just the history and the narration of Socrates' life to getting to that deep theology and introducing syllogisms like that Paul would use in Romans 6. Jesus Christ died once and for all to death. We died with Christ through baptism. Therefore, we are dead to sin. How can we live in any longer? And so even in the New Testament, you can have different allusions or echoes back to this philosophy. Sometimes you have specific quotations of those, like you mentioned in Acts 17. But there's other times where they're taking those and they're turning it over on its head. And and then one thing beyond that is just the rhetorical situation. And so Paul rarely actually uses the word philosophy. But when he talks about how it didn't come with this great and philosophical words or of eloquence, he actually says that, and that's a very philosophical note that he's making. You would have philosophers who would say, I don't come with this great philosophy, but instead I come with the logos, as divine truth, and I'm not like those other sophists that are out there. But anyway, right. So yeah, this was very popular, and there's a debate among New Testament scholars, especially with Paul, did Paul have like a Greco-Roman education? Did he go to gymnasium? How long was that? Was he in high school? Did he have an undergraduate degree in that? And you'd have a guy like George Van Cooten who would say, yeah, Paul, you know, having grown up in Tarsus, which is one of the kind of the Ivy League towns of that day, he goes back to Tarsus after his conversion, that Paul would be very familiar with these works. And then you would have those like Oda Bischmeyer, who would say, no, this is just it's in the air. And so like we might say, the unexamined life is not worth living. Someone might say that today who has never actually read Socrates. And so Paul is that spermalogos, that armchair philosopher who hasn't actually read or studied these things. He's just kind of picking them up out of his cultural milieu. And then you have N.T. Wright that I mentioned earlier that would kind of have a middle way there that's saying, no, Paul is, he's taking these, he's accommodating them. So he understands those backgrounds, but he's taking those and mapping those thoughts onto the climax of the covenant and the story of Israel.
And can I ask you where you fall in those debates?
Yeah, I would probably be somewhere between Van Cooten and N.T. Wright. And so if there's a middle ground between those two, I would be there. So I do think that it's not just Paul mapping it on the story of Israel, that there's some more apocalyptic influence that is drawing on. And so I would be more of an apocalyptic Paul, which, again, when we think of apocalyptic, we often just think of Judaism. We think of First Enoch. We think of 4 Ezra. We think of like Revelation as apocalyptic. But just as I mentioned with the end of the Republic, of Plato's Republic, you have this apocalyptic notion. So after Plato, there's this guy named Cicero. And Cicero was, it wasn't a card-carrying Stoic, but he was influenced by that. And he also wrote a Republic. And his Republic ends with the dream of Scipio. And Scipio goes into the stars and he hears and sees the different heavens, and he wants to just stay there, but his dad says he has to go back and live a righteous life for the sake of the state in order to do that. And so, again, there's sometimes this tendency just to think of apocalyptic thought as just Jewish, but we see in that roundabout that we've used earlier that there's mutual bleeding, there's mutual interpenetration between Judaism and Greco-Roman thought that is influencing Paul.
That was the most sane summary of Scipio that I've ever heard, because anybody who's read that text knows it gets really freaky really quick. And I think Paul, so we have Socrates is Jesus, beloved disciple is Plato, that's John is Plato, and then Paul is Aristotle. And I think the Paul-Aristotle connection works well because I'm in the Presbyterian tradition. And man, they preach Paul like nobody's business in that tradition, but they're often preaching kind of like Paul, the systematic theologian, but honestly, Paul is also the practical theologian, right? He's the one kind of like Aristotle who is dragging all this back into the ground, into the bodies, like this has to be lived out, right? In this particular
Exactly.
Way. Fascinating. Thank you very much for that summary. That's actually really helpful. And again, I will steal that from you as well. That's a really easy way for Christians to kind of get their head around what's going on. Hmm. Now, the big question is, and this is also a debate in your field, but one of the big questions is there a Hebrew intellectual world that is then put into conversation with this Hellenistic Greco-Roman world, or does the philosophical world of Hellenism that enters Judaism, right, because of the conquest, does it basically create some kind of Jewish intellectualism? Or so I guess, was intellectualism already there in your mind, or does the fact that they have to contend with the Greeks create their sense of intellectualism?
Yeah, again, I don't think Judaism was monolithic, so I don't think we can make a broad blanket statement saying that all of Judaism was intellectual. I do think that we have to consider the influence of the exile as well, and so the Babylonian captivity and the Persians influencing that. But I think from the very beginning, you have this connection. So to borrow from Philo, although he's going to be later than what the question that you're asking. Philo is going to connect this idea of God speaking and the word to this logos. And so I think with Philo, and again, Philo's in Alexandria, which is one of the other hubs of kind of the great Greco-Roman thought and influencing Judaism. But he's going to take it back to this idea of God being a God of logic, a God of reason, loving God with your mind, maybe to bring Jesus into it a little bit. So I think that there was definitely this tradition, this intellectual tradition that we see in the quote unquote wisdom tradition. I know that is a debated term right now, but I think being made in the image of God includes for at least some segments of Jewish thinkers that would influence the idea of wisdom that takes us back to the very beginning of God being that logos. Now, what I see with Second Temple Judaisms is that there were some that they would see Hellenism as that which, hey, we can borrow from this. We can take from this Greco-Roman thought to buttress our faith. And this philosophy, this Plato stuff is not a threat to us. And it's not even like watering down our Judaism. It's not like we're compromising, but instead it helps us enhance our thought. And so almost this idea, and I think you might have this in the Presbyterian church, but the all truth is God's truth. And so there were some that could take it and use it. And so John Barclay in his book, which has a terrible title, very unsexy cover, but it is an amazing book, Jews in the Mediterranean Diaspora.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, I said Paul and the Gift. I was like, that's not such a bad title.
No. So this is one of the first books that John Barclay drops.
Okay.
And it's Jews in the Palestinian Diaspora, and then it has dates after it. But he talks about the different levels of assimilation, acculturation, and accommodation, and works in different groups of Jews that would fall on those different lines. Assimilation being basically Jews becoming Greek would be a total of that. Or on the other side of that spectrum, poo-pooing or rejecting, repudiating Judaism. I'm sorry, Greco-Roman thought and culture altogether. The acculturation is going to deal with their education. And so you would have some that wouldn't even know how to speak Greek, all the way to those like our Philo that we've mentioned before, who may have a PhD in Greek. You know, you read his Greek over against like John to bring back the beloved disciple. You can see that Philo has much more acculturation than even in John, and even more than Paul, maybe closer to Luke and the author of Hebrews. Right. And then the last one is that accommodation. So those who had acculturation, how did they use it? Did they use it to basically see Greco-Roman philosophy and understanding as eclipsing Jewish thought? Or did they use it against it, where you would take the Greco-Roman thought and then use it as a weapon to take captive every thought that sets itself up against the knowledge of Israel's God, to borrow from or to jack a phrase from Paul? And so he talks about those three different influences. And I would see those type of influences not just in Jewish thought, but also in the Jewish thought that the early Christians inherit. Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder, so if we think about rejectionist, you know, we could put maybe the Essenes, the Dead Sea Scroll community, which again is communities because it seems to be a little bit more diverse group of people. They've been in the news a lot lately, but that might have been people who just rejected the whole thing outright. You see some Hellenistic Jewish texts where female heroes are the kinds that reject Hellenism and actually go after the Hellenist leaders. So, yeah, there is a rejectionist movement. There is a, hey, let's take this and run with it. And then there's people who are mixing and matching, where it's, you know, chewing the meat and spitting out the bones, if I can simplify it that much.
It's good.
If we can go back to the Gospel of John, and just what you said there reminded me of the question I had earlier, but you were on fire, so I was just letting you go. But there, I mean, there's this interesting dynamic in the Gospel of John that he's using this logos philosophy. Mm-hmm. Daniel Boyarin has argued that that's actually preexistent pretty heavily in Jewish thought for that period. So it's not a brand new idea. But you have this other interesting phenomenon going on in John is that his Greek is not that great. he struggles a little bit with the language, but he seems to have these really sophisticated philosophical moves going on, both at the beginning and I would say even at the end, and even narratively, he's using some fairly sophisticated literary devices. All at the same time as misspelling words and misconjugating verbs sometimes, right?
Exactly.
So what do we do with that? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? Just to spring a rando idea on you?
I haven't thought through that. I don't have a ready answer for it.
Fair enough.
I would say, though, to maybe spin it to something I do find interesting, is that in John's gospel, you have the underlining over and over again that it is the bodily resurrection. So Thomas wants to feel the body. Jesus eats and drinks in front of them. And so that could be pushing back against kind of this middle Platonism or Stoic idea of that incorporeal body afterlife, that Jesus is not a ghost. Ghosts do not have flesh and blood.
Right,
and so even so, from John 1 to towards the ending, you could have this accommodation, acculturation of that. But it may be that John was really good in his philosophy class, but really bad in his baby Greek class.
Yeah, we can't fault him. But the flip side to that is, high education is not the bar that's set for having a fully intellectualized faith, right? The full penetration of the intellectual aspects of the Torah and Jesus's life, it doesn't require you to be a master student, I guess.
Mm-hmm. They realized that he was untrained, but they took note that he had been with Jesus.
Yeah. Well, and even then, now that you say that, I think not only Thomas, but, you know, in John 5:6, this kind of, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, like he drives he drives that further than any other gospel, I guess. And again, that's the part that Paul uniquely runs into trouble with in Athens. Like, everybody's with him while he's making these broad, sweeping, Stoic-like arguments. And there's come a day appointed where he's going to judge by resurrection. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you were to say, okay, so somebody's listening to this. They've never heard of or thought about any of this before in their lives. This is all kind of brand new to them. And they're thinking, okay, I didn't know. I didn't realize this was all connected this deeply. Where would you send people to read, something just to get them on the ground running, thinking about the context in which the New Testament texts come to us?
Good. Yeah. So I would say read the Apocrypha. Again, growing up in my missionary Baptist world, the Apocrypha, that was that Roman Catholic. It was dangerous. Mm-hmm. It was a four-letter word. Even those in the church tradition who didn't consider the Apocrypha as inspired, they considered it inspiring to read. And so, as you know from Martin Luther, a lot of his problems that he had with the papia, with the Roman Catholics, was some misunderstandings of what we'd like to see in 4 Maccabees or Sirach. Mm-hmm. But even when he does his translation, he includes the Apocrypha.
Right.
But he moves it to the back. So maybe just reading through the Apocrypha and reading these different types of works, and you see so many similarities, having just having an understanding of the Old and New Testament, you see just this great bridge between the Old Testament and New Testament, similar to even Paul's call on the road to Damascus, where God knocks him off his donkey. There's similarities of stories in Second Maccabees and in Four Maccabees of this happening, and there being a high priest that prays for him so that he's so that he's healed after he can't see because he's got knocked off his donkey. And there's this testimony that he's going to take the message of the Jews to the world, mm-hmm. to the Greeks. And so just kind of a cursory reading of the Apocrypha, and you're going to see a lot of these similarities and possibly even pushbacks. I mentioned Four Maccabees, but Four Maccabees would almost be like the anti-Galatians. For Four Maccabees, the way that you walk according to the Spirit, that you don't satisfy the desires of your sinful nature, is by snip-snip, circumcision. It's by abstaining from food sacrifices. And so to kind of hear who Paul's greatest opponent would be, the author Four Maccabees writes this, that Judaism is the most philosophy, it's the mo better philosophy than all of that. And it actually is what helps you achieve self-control. It's that which helps you achieve righteousness. It's that which helps you achieve the prudence, the cardinal virtues and courage. And so sometimes you'll see some similarities with the narrative. Sometimes you'll see some contrast even with the theology. So I would say read the Apocrypha. If you want an introduction to the Greco-Roman world, especially around the first century, the Stoics that I mentioned, Marcus Aurelius is kind of a good one. His book on Meditations, it's kind of like the pop. It's kind of like the Taylor Swift of Stoicism.
I think a lot of people would read and go like, oh yeah, this is kind of, a lot of this is common sense. Some of it would be mystifying, but yeah.
Right, right. And so his Meditations would be, again, kind of the Taylor Swift. For your more indie group, maybe Epictetus, because Epictetus is going to be the most religious of the Stoics.
Right.
And he was a slave that was set free. And then, of course, the guy that I like the most is Seneca. Seneca's brother was Gallio, who adjudicated on Paul's behalf in Corinth. And so he's probably who Paul would have stood before in Rome, because Nero wasn't really worried about court cases at that time. And he has numerous works, essays that he's written, like on why does God allow people to suffer, providence. And then he has letters that he wrote to kind of his young Timothy, Lucilius, and he also has dramas that influenced Shakespearean type dramas, according to the scholars. And so, yeah, he's the most prolific of the Roman writers, of the Roman Stoics, but probably the least popular. So read those primary sources. And then a shameless plug would be, if you want to know more about the intersection or the roundabout between Judaism and Greco-Roman philosophy, a book that I edited with Dave Briones, Paul and the Giants of Philosophy with IBP Academic.
I was going to mention this book, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, so we've taken some of the rising stars in this area, and we've asked them to take their PhD theses and dissertations and to write them for a more popular audience, to bring what we have cooking in the ivory tower down to everyone's kitchen. And so it introduces all of those. And some of the things that I said about the Greco-Roman background, you would get that written out in the introduction to that book.
And that book is very readable, Paul and the Giants of Philosophy. So yeah, I could hand that to just about anybody and feel like they could figure out what was going on there. Also, I want to mention, because I agree, the Apocrypha is a fantastic place to start, and lots of good study. But I know the Oxford Annotated Bible, which is not that expensive for the paperback, has really good introductions to those texts to kind of help orient you when this was written, what was the context, what was the language, and good notes on it as well. Well, Dr. Joey Dodson, thank you so much for your wisdom and your guidance in this very complicated area of biblical scholarship.
Thanks for having me. I've had a blast.
You've been listening to the Biblical Mind podcast, exploring the deep structures of Christian scripture. For more, visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org. Subscribe to this podcast at all the usual places so you never miss an episode.